Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 62, section 4, which is old single column, page 706. Okay, so we have the final flourish of this paper. These remaining sections, up through section 7 there to end it off, are really all about launching the story of the first two humans. It's a very poignant story. Well known to longtime readers, and it it picks up where we left off in the preceding session. Recall we had gone from the beginnings, the quivering on the very brink state here in the evolution of the biologic system with those early lemur types, quote unquote, that they described there in the first section, and then we had a couple suddenlies. We had a suddenly to give us the dawn mammals, and then an even more pregnant with potential suddenly to give us the mid mammals, and they already hinted at. In passing, or mentioned in passing, what we're getting to now is that immediate precursor. The creatures amongst whom are going to be the mother and father of the first two humans, the primates. And recall that we saw that they were pointing out that one of the phenomena that was definitively in place as we went from those lemur like creatures forward was this coincidentally, quote unquote, of having twins being born in a suddenly. One male, one female, coincidentally. They pointed out that was there enough in place with the dawn mammals. They said as a rule, offspring were born singly, although twins were occasional. However, they cleaned up a little loose end where they mentioned that that first dawn mammal. That wasn't twins. See, so before the dawn mammals, that twin phenomenon wasn't quite in place, and you just had a male that was born, and then there was a slow upstepping of those dawn mammals from that single individual. But then, you had a pair, a male and female twins for the mid mammals to start the mid mammals, and here. Yet again to get the primates, and then of course yet again to get the first two humans. So just how economically designed this system is. Right? Again, it speaks to the fact that it's all designed and it's all over controlled. It isn't some arbitrary, haphazard, random, whatever phenomenon. There's no need for lots of of first humans. You just need two, one male and one female, and that's the minimum requirement, and so that's what you get. So that fact that there's that inherent economy in the system, not only in the sense of that I'm kind of immediately using it there, but think about that literal sense of that, you know, that's behind that word economy, the laws of the house, right? That everything is governed by law, right? There's an infinite order, right, in place, and we're all in that infinite order, right? There's nothing that is genuinely arbitrary and haphazard. It all fits into an infinite plan, and just those little details say a lot, right? I mean, no neo-Darwinist, you know, would ever assume, right, that humans began with, you know, a male and a female pair and a suddenly. let alone, you know, the two steps before it as well. Or that you don't need a lot of time to go from the quivering on the very brink to the first few humans, so it doesn't take a lot of time. We're in that full geometric culmination, right, of the whole system coming together, and the wholeness of it is beginning to be very manifest. You know, there's a kairos afoot in the chronos, if you will, right? There's a fullness of time, you know, in the midst of the moments of time, and so it's all coming together. This synthesis and this coalescence of the whole of the finite. Having its very poignant little expression on this planet a million years ago, and so that's why the revelators write with that, you know, tell the story, you know, poignantly. They could have, you know, kind of avoided that and just told it in a very bland, matter-of-fact way, but they want, you know, they wanted to make sure you appreciated that. You know, it seems like just two simple little first humans, but it's actually a distillation of infinity, right? Made fact. Yeah. So it's a cool thing to think about.
What an insight. Good God.
Yeah. All right. So let's do it. Remember they're the primates called, they're using that term because unlike we use it in a not very precise way, they're using it in a very precise way. You know, this is the primacy, the first order, the highest order of animal life. We've reached the apex, you know, and so they are the first ones, in the entire order of animals. They are the primates.
Right. Section 4, the primates. Going back to the birth of the superior twins, one male and one female, to the two leading members of the mid-mammal tribe. These animal babies were of an unusual order. They had still less hair on their bodies than their parents, and when very young, insisted on walking upright. Their ancestors had always learned to walk on their hind legs, but these primate twins stood erect from the beginning. They attained a height of over 5 feet, and their heads grew larger in comparison with others among the tribe. While early learning to communicate with each other by means of signs and sounds, they were never able to make their people understand these new symbols.
Okay, so, you know, a bunch of things, just, you know, quickly in vignette there. You know, remember why they start out going back to the birth of the superior twins, because remember, they, in just, in the, you know, at the end of the preceding section, they were telling us about that, you know, that other pair of twins that was very limited in nature. Back to the point at hand, in other words, and you were wondering, it's like, well, you know, how's, you know, we know we started out the dawn mammals, you know, remember, were still described as, let's see, I think it was, wasn't it, hairy and agile, wasn't that the phrase that they used in there? Something like that. They were hairy and agile and chattered in monkey-like fashion. Right. So, you know, the first step, you know, you know, they were still definitively hairy. And it's getting less and less each time, just like the hands are getting more and more human-like each time, the feet are getting more and more human-like each time. The whole erect, you know, fact is getting more and more definitive each time we do it suddenly. And so, you know, they're pointing that out, that, you know, they hit the ground, as it were, upright now, right? Very young, they insisted on walking upright. So you've left, even before you get to the first two humans, you've completely left behind any, you know, post-birth manifestation of, you know, of a pre-upright nature. You know, that whole ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny thing, right? That you're, the development of an individual is in parallel to the evolution of the species over, you know, all of evolutionary time. You know, you've gotten to the point where all of that is in the rearview mirror by the time they're born now, right? And you don't have, you know, it tailing out post-birth before it really kind of gets to definitively upright. However, as we all know, right? I mean, it's not until roughly age six that even today, well, we get the seventh adjutant inserted into us, and we get inserted in the Holy Spirit, and our personality engages us. So, I mean, there's still a lot of very important aspects of factualizing our humanity that happens post-birth. You know, one of those definitive things from a biologic perspective, you know, the upright nature, you know, we've got that. So, you know, any thoughts that there were, you know, by archaeologists that there were, you know, ancient humans that weren't totally upright yet? No. I mean, the pre-humans were totally upright. You know, if you see anything like that, you know that's a false interpretation of the data. Okay, so these primates twins stood erect from the beginning, and they attained a height of over 5 feet. Okay, so, you know, we've gone from less than 3 to over 4, now we're already over 5. Okay, and that's, you know, pretty striking. Okay, so we haven't gotten humans yet, and we're over 5. I mean, we've got creatures that are taller than what the diminutive aspects of Indigo Man produce in humans today, right? I mean, you know, saying that they're over 5 means they're over pygmy or even any pygmoid peoples, you know, on the planet, right? I mean, that's literally, you know, where they kind of draw that line. Is right there, you know, that if, you know, if you're shorter than, say, you know, 5'1", you're one of those very diminutive types, you know, throughout the areas that Indigo Man, you know, had a lot of influence. You know, the shortest stature.
Even the old British, you know, I mean, even the old Europeans were not very tall at all.
Right. Yeah. Not to mention, right, that there can be others that, you know, recall the reason for that. You know, Blue Man was just a little bit taller than Indigo Man. Right. I mean, blue is next to the shortest, you know, in red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo. So, you know, that too, you know, just to note that simple little fact, like, whoa, you know, again, it reminds you of how much of what we think of as being a definitive sign of a human being, you know, is there long before you get the actual first two humans. We've been noting, I mean, all the basic emotional things are all in place and everything. I mean, so by the time you get to the first two humans, you really have everything of the fancy animal. Right, the only thing that you're lacking is genuine human reflective augmentation of emotions and stuff. You know, and it's sad to record that most people on the planet don't even manifest that. So, right, this is what we've been, you know, the Revelators have been pointing it out, and I've been stressing it. I mean, they're trying to get us to appreciate that, you know, an awful lot of what we call quote unquote human is not. It's dawn mammal or mid mammal or, you know, you don't, you know, you write dramas based upon the pre-human attributes here, not on the human attributes. So, you know, it's all, you know, it's all trying to challenge us like that. Take delight in cultivating being distinct, right? From just these poignant emotional phenomena that are the pre-humans here.
You know, aren't there cases of, I think they're called feral children, they were human, but somehow they were raised by animals of some kind?
You know. Well, I mean, right, you can always have nurture issues.
But what happened, yeah. Has anybody ever, have you ever followed that case to see what happened to them when they were put into, you know, with the rest of the humans and stuff?
Well,
did they ever come out of it? I mean, do they walk?
Yeah.
Did they go on all fours?
Right. I mean, again, you can be trained, you know, from an early age to do all kinds of things. You know, nurture is a very potent force. Remember how much that comes into play when you talk about, you know, Cain and Abel, right? The nature nurture issue. But they remind you there that if the genetics are sound, I mean, eventually you can. You can overcome a lot of very detrimental or limited, you know, issues of environment, you know, of rearing, of nurture. You know, and, you know, as long as there isn't, you know, physical deformity that's been imposed, you know, from extreme things, you know, but, you know, or brain damage or whatnot, you know, if the environment is too extreme, obviously, you know, you can't overcome because you're damaged. But you know, anyway, there, you know, the whole point is just to appreciate that you have a solid foundation, even as the first two humans. And the challenge is to not rest on those laurels, right? To do something upward from that foundation. Right, we're called humans, up from the humus, right? You know, and we're reaching the apex of the humus, right? You know, that which is, you know, really of the earth, right? And is and is just, you know, very, you know, in a very definitive sense, natural, right? And we're about to have something quite extraordinary happen, where that which is above, you know, overtly reaches down, right? And there's an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, and there's a personality that identifies, right, top down, you know, rather than just this apex of the bottom up, where that which is more than dirt is covert within the dirt. Right, is hidden as the subtleties within the design of matter and mind, energy, and we're about to get to where it definitively is reached down to from above, right, in an overt way that that high beings can see happen, right? so anyway. Yeah, so over 5 feet, you know, that should really catch your attention if you're thinking about that fact. And then, you know, we obviously, you know, mentioning heads grew larger, right? We were getting you literally have to have a bigger brain to seat a greater and greater quantity of adjutant activity upon. Remember each of the, I mean, back when we read paper 36, and we talked about the adjutants, there's both a quantity and a quality, you know, aspect to that engagement by the adjutant mind spirits. And so you just see it, you know, it's a literal fact, the fact that there's a literal mind energy, you know, that's attuned to literal material energy. You know, you see this quantity synchronization. Yeah, the brain has to be bigger, and then the little thing here. Notice while early learning to communicate, you know, and they're talking about, we have these signs and sounds, you know, these very symbols that are coming into play. We don't literally have language, though. Right? You have ever more sophisticated functioning of mind as an animal phenomenon, but you don't have, because that which is above hasn't literally kind of come down and plugged in, you don't have that phenomenon of reality really coming down into a mind superconsciously, right, unconsciously, and supplying this subtle framework in which language, quote unquote, is distilled. Okay. Using that subtlety of words to indicate that difference. Just because there's, in definitive, like they said, they were never able to make their people understand. So the primates can have a sophistication and precision of this symbology that makes the mid mammals' eyes glaze over. Right.
It has to have this framework, like the supreme, mm-hmm. Has to create right. that, and the mind has to be. Right. Evolved far enough, which it is.
Now. Yeah, see, here it's more, it's still more just the mind functioning and, in this adaptive mode and stuff getting generated. Okay, but when you have a genuine human, what you're doing most fundamentally with language. Okay. Is discovering, not generating, but you're discovering that which already exists, right? And you discover words before you discover the facts that they go with, right?
Other place on the planet that has that insight. There's no place you can look and put together, tie together, because you put that together. Mm-hmm. If you look at the screen paper, that framework, and it's obvious. It starts becoming apparent that that's what's going on. But there's no other place to find that.
Well, see, and again, it's important to notice that because you want to go beyond the facts. You want to begin to feel the truth of these things, right? The truth, the discovery of truth of these of facts will, you'll have a reality response. You'll feel that. It'll be poignant. It'll awaken things in your mind that, have been dormant all your life, right? A wholeness and a real livingness, right? That's not been there before. You'll begin to really discover what you can obey, right? That which you can obey truth, right? You feel this dynamic, flowing, living nature in your consciousness, right? That you can strike step with, right? The facts are just dead and lay there, right? And can't be obeyed. But anyway, so there, right? There's this greater sophistication of communication. You're getting all of the technical machinery in place, right? For language, right? But it's uninspired, right? This chattering. The chattering is getting more and more sophisticated, right? And it starts to involve lots of hand waving, like me here, when I talk all the time and I'm always doing all the hand motions, right?
And we don't understand.
but it doesn't have that wholeness framework in which it exists, and hence it's not quote unquote inspired, inspirited. It does not have the Holy Spirit framework, right, that it's occurring within. But now, just to finish up that thought, with the fifth epical revelation, we're finally getting disclosed the facts that are tied to the words that we discovered oh so long ago. Words like spirit and truth and personality, and, you know, we could go on and on and on, almost every word of any consequence, right? We've had the words forever, right? We've had the word philosophy for 2,600 years, and no one's known what it meant, right? No one has known what fact that you point to and say, that word is describing that fact, right? We just had this word, and we've been groping around. It's like, well, how about let's apply it to that or that, or, right? You know, is that spirit, or is that spirit? Is that personality, right? Is that meaning? The fifth epical revelation allows us to really get going with this discovery of the elements of reality. Okay, so all right, so they are communicating in a very sophisticated fashion, and you can definitely envision that, you know, you've got a creature that they could do most of the things that we do in our day-to-day life, right? They could pass for a human in many circumstances, right? They've got the sophistication of mind, right? You know, they could do a lot of basic things. And it reminds you, you could have a human that's born, you know, not all together, right? You know, and they're, you know, they can do some basic jobs. You can't give them a job where they need to reflect, right? Because they can't, you know, to any significant degree. But you can give them a kind of a basic, you know, mechanical sort of a job. Well, you know, these primates, you could plug them right into the same position. So, you
know. So if they couldn't understand new symbols, would they have problems playing Candy Crush?
Oh, the consequences of these statements, yes. All right. Okay, now, what else do we have here in terms of, you know, these, you know, like, you know, we've been following kind of these key threads, how they've been taking these jumps with each of the suddenlies. What else do we have here stepping forward?
When about 14 years of age, they fled from the tribe, going west to raise their family and establish the new species of primates. And these new creatures are very properly denominated primates, since they were the direct and immediate animal ancestors of the human family itself.
Like I said, just reminding you again of, you know, why they're using that term there. They're reminding you again. They're primacy amongst all animals.
Still on the peninsula?
Well, yeah, this is all on the peninsula, you know, which geography does not exist anymore. So, right, so, yeah, any sort of paleontology of all this stuff is, you know, out of the question. There is no land here anymore. So here you see, you know, again, another step where they have more and more of a recognition of different differences. And, you know, and you know, the beginnings of judgment, right, about this, like, you know, our mid-mammal brethren are a little limited, and I think maybe we should not mate with them. Why don't we go over there, all right, so, and, you know, having that recognition when they're just 14, right, so, you know, striking step with some sophistication of thought at a pretty young age. That's what I'm getting at. See, even before you have Andan and Fanta doing something similar, only even more profound, going north, right? You have the beginnings of that. So, like I said, it's just all the kind of machinery is going to all be in place, right? It just needs the cherry on top, right? With Andan and Fanta, everything is all very close. You know, it just needs that subtlety. You know, you don't want to just, you know, distinguish. You want to be able to discriminate, right? And that goes, you know, that's when it really goes from fancy animal to human. Yeah. Was there something here? Yeah.
I'm going west. Jumps out at me because mm-hmm. I've always only liked west or north. And so, there's something about that direction, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah, that's.
Well, because south is lazier because it's so hot.
Or
right, there's all kinds of mythology, you know, about the West that you can go, huh, you suppose. I can't say definitively, but you can just note in passing that coincidentally they go to kind of the mythological West, right? See, you know, it's kind of interesting. Yeah. Okay, so let's see, anything else there? You notice that you know they fled the tribe. Remember, you know that was another thing. We, you know, the mid mammals. Remember, had all that warring, and they got boiled down to just that one little nugget tribe.
It might be that the area on the west was not the most favorable, so they would be left. More likely left alone.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, that's an obvious thing that you might suspect, that it was more salubrious to the east and south. Right, right. There would be all the issues of the prevailing winds, and how the rains and all that sort of stuff. You know, that's a very likely reason. But their more sophisticated nature could deal with more difficult situations. Okay, get some more here.
Thus it was that the primates came to occupy a region on the west coast of the Mesopotamian Peninsula, as it then projected into the Southern Sea. While the less intelligent and closely related tribes lived around the peninsula point and up the eastern shoreline.
Okay, so there you see the details in it. As it then projected into the Southern Sea, and now not a hint of it, right? It's just a horizontal coastline there. I mean, that's, you know, and there's no shelf or anything. Like I said, you look at the ocean depth maps there. I mean, it's just totally gone. I mean, it's all nothing but seafloor there now. Fossil digging possible. Plus, you know, as we've seen, there probably wasn't anything left. I mean, you know, most of the time here, the more advanced group are killing off the previous group, and they're probably eating them all. Right? So, you know, you probably wouldn't have any fossils anyway. You couldn't even maybe stumble upon, you know, some signs of ancient habitation or something, right? You know, it's just all gone. But you do notice that they're hugging the shorelines, right? And so,
same today.
Yeah. And this is because of the same day. You know, a lot of the same reasons. You know, at least you don't. You can't have enemies coming from one direction, you know, that direction, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, issues. Now, whether or not they were taking advantage of any food from the sea, possibly. Don't know how sophisticated they were. They're going to have a pretty sophisticated use of the fourth adjuvant, these creatures, so they would have been able to do some rudimentary tool sort of stuff. You know, they might have been harvesting the sea to some degree for food. Okay.
The primates were more human and less animal than their mid-mammal predecessors. The skeletal proportions of this new species were very similar to those of the primitive human races. The human type of hand and foot had fully developed, and these creatures could walk and even run as well as any of their later-day human descendants. They largely abandoned tree life, though continuing to resort to the treetops as a safety measure at night, for like their earlier ancestors, they were greatly subject to fear. The increased use of their hands did much to develop inherent brain power, but they did not yet possess minds that could really be called human.
And you say, oh, really, right? We aren't there in fact, but like I've been stressing, we're there in truth, you know, to ever more quivering on the very brink, you know, degrees. Notice that the skeletal proportions were very similar. As we'll read, you know, later on, as I mentioned often, you had 7,000 different lines of creatures that were all very close to humans, you know, and, you know, could be mated with, you know, easily. And, see, they're reminding you of that. We have fully developed, you know, the hand and the foot. So, I mean, in many ways, if you just were, you know, to look at the skeleton of one of these creatures, you know, you would decide, oh, this is obviously a human. This looks almost exactly like a modern human. See, but it's not human. I mean, you've gotten all of the basic, like I said, the mechanical, you know, and mind stuff that's really tied immediately to the body. All of that's in place. All that's missing is the cherry on top, right? All that's missing is that higher mind that's in many ways more attuned to that which is above than that which is below, the sixth and seventh adjutants. Right? They're designed really to be anchored above rather than below, unlike the first five adjutants. And it's just that cherry on top, and the encirclement of the Holy Spirit, and, you know, and the personality identification that comes with it. The distinction, the next big suddenly, right, to get the first two humans, is in many ways not that, you know, immediately visible, right, body-wise. I mean, there are some issues they'll point out, but you know, it's more that subtlety of mind that is the big difference. Yeah.
So one might think logically that the brain power would come before the increased use of the hands, but the increased use of the hands seemed, they say, it did much to increase the brain power. Can you explain that to
me? Yeah, I was going to get to that. Just that they're pointing out that you have this attunement, you know, between mind and body, where if the mind is going to function in a more precise mode, there has to be a body that can also, you know, focus in a very precise mode, you know, fingers that can pick up tiny instruments and do very precise things, you know, write the Lord's Prayer on a grain of rice, you know, that sort of thing. You know, to be able to focus in with such minute precision, the body and mind are synchronized like this. Yeah. So this is why, you know, when people speculate in science fiction, you know, that you could have some cloven-hoofed phenomenon, you know, that is, you know, a vast intelligence. No, that doesn't happen, right? You know, if there's a finely operating mind, there's a body that can that's commensurate with that mind, and you know, you've got there's a back and forth, as they're pointing out there, right? The increased use of their hands did much to develop inherent brain power. I mean, we all, you know, especially for the last, you know, a little over 100 years, psychologists have, you know, gone a long ways to understanding how important a lot of these things are to our development. And I mean, if you don't take delight in cultivating a finer use of your motor skills, you know, the mind and brain never develop in that way. I mean, it's the basic issue of you're born with certain abilities, just innately, genetically, but there's all kinds of skill potential that you can develop, right? And they're just pointing that out, right? That the more you nurture, you know, in a skill mode, right, the more the adjutants come into play in that regard, and the whole material foundation that supports that adjutant activity is built. Right? I mean, you got all kinds of structures in the brain that literally have to be there to have all of that complexity of mind seated on.
Okay, so that proven that with the connection between music, math, and so, and higher brain, lots of merit scholars that are high school musicians, and they're kind of seeing how that works together, and it
makes me think, like you said, it's a back and forth, because mm-hmm. when you said focus, you know, is it the ability to focus first or the ability to use your hands intricately? And all these musicians are having to use different amounts of intricate things. Mm-hmm. They really have to develop those muscles pretty early on, or they don't, they're almost cannot develop the muscles in their hands at a pianist. That's my excuse. Mm-hmm. If you don't do it at a young age, you can't hardly do it when you're older.
Right. Right. Yeah. See, and a lot of that is just simply because, like what I was saying, I mean, it's only when you're quite young that you're still in the mode where, you know, when the brain can be formed as a foundation for that ongoing, you know, skill. You know, and there comes a point when there's not a lot of reworking of the brain that can happen, right? You know, like the Relvigers point out, I mean, you know, if a lot of stuff hasn't happened by age 8, it's not going to happen because everything is kind of just, you know, cemented, you know. I mean, there's always exceptions, but you know, that basic, you know, thing to understand, you know, I mean, you literally don't have enough structures built in the brain for the seventh adjutant to seed on it until age 6, right? So in that same spirit, you have all the other details of, you know, you might have all 7 adjutants seated, but, you know, at what level are they functioning? You know, we've had just 5 adjutants here, and we're making huge strides as we go from dawn mammals to mid mammals to the primates. You know, the sophistication of those 5 adjutants, right, to the point where you'd swear there must be more adjutants that have been added. I mean, there's so much greater functioning going on. No, it's, you know, it's the same 5 adjutants, but they're vast in their potential. If you don't take delight in cultivating, not only you're not going to be using the 3 cosmic intuitions and the Holy Spirit, you're not going to be using the adjutants, you know, at any sort of a sophisticated level. You're just going to be going along with what's kind of just there by nature, right? You know, and that's another reason why it's problematic when people overplay the natural, right? And your natural temperament, you know, in other words, what adjutant mind activity you have just, you know, naturally, you know, with the genetics and with your nature, you know, and declaring that to be your personality, right, and your eternal, you know, gift, you know, or your gift of eternal nature from the eternal God, and you don't want to change that, or, you know, see, it's very problematic to think in those terms, right, because you become a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, when you think like that. You know, the real human is creative, is an art form, right? It is artificial. It's what's built upon what you have, you know, just by biologic grace. You know, that's the true human. Okay, so we got the whole thing. So they're arrayed all the way around the coast. It's fascinating. It reminds you of India, you know, when they talk like this. This Mesopotamian peninsula, you know, seems to fit kind of a parallel to the phenomenon you have with India. There was one other little thing. Yeah, just they were greatly subject to fear, you know, like their early ancestors. I just wanted to point that out. Even though we're making great strides in higher functioning of mind, that dawn mammal foundation is, you know, we're not transcending it, right? We kind of stress that back there. Remember, I mean, that human fear was laid there, and it just, you know, continues forward. It doesn't get left behind here. Stuff just gets piled on top of it. You know, and the problem yet is we haven't gotten to the point where you can flip around and put your feet on the cosmos instead of on that fear foundation. Right? You know, you perforce serve one master yet, right? See? No option of serving that other master.
When you're facing some big old ugly tiger.
I mean, it's handy to have that fear master in play, right? You know, but anyway.
Actually getting out of
Let's see. Yeah, okay, so yep, keep going here.
Although in emotional nature the primates differ little from their forebears, they exhibited more of a human trend in all of their propensities. They were, indeed, splendid and superior animals, reaching maturity at about 10 years of age and having a natural lifespan of about 40 years. That is, they might have lived that long had they died natural deaths. But in those early days, very few animals ever died a natural death. The struggle for existence was altogether too intense.
Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned, so that whole bit, yeah, we're definitely talking about longevity here, not life expectancy, right? Life expectancy is short. but you see, we're definitely making some significant strides, right? I mean, we went from 25 to 40, right? For the longevity. So that's a big jump. I mean, you know, it went from 20 to 25 in the previous jump. Okay, went much bigger jump here in that regard. The maturity age is lengthening. Again, a sign that you're getting closer and closer to human. The more animal you are, the more you literally do hit the ground running, right? Because you have to, because if you don't, you know, you're going to get eaten by a predator, right? So you got to be able to just pop out of the womb and, you know, shake yourself off a little bit and off you go, right? Because the tiger's coming, right?
Or even the winged thing.
Yeah.
You can have a tiger for the little one.
Yep. So that's, you know, notable. And see again how they're just stressing what I was saying. Although the emotional nature of the primates differed little, right? So again, we've laid a lot of what's going to be the first and second levels of meaning. You know, an awful lot of that is in place already. The basic mechanical, material oriented part is all pretty much in place. Just exhibited more of a human trend in all their propensities. You're maximizing the fanciness of the animal, right? That final little bits of sophistication and finery that the first five adjutants can muster. Okay, you know, leaning into, you know, human quality, but, you know, not being able to cross the threshold. Okay, I think we got everything else there. Yep.
And now, after almost 900 generations of development, covering about 21,000 years from the origin of the dawn mammals, the primates suddenly gave birth to two remarkable creatures, the first true human beings.
Okay, so there's our big suddenly, and we'll get into the details as we go forward. And we'll get more about the primates, too, as we go forward. We don't leave the primates behind here. Like I said, it's kind of all the same story here for the rest of the paper. But this little tidbit. So all it took, right, is almost 900 generations. Very geometric, right? Very nonlinear climax here. Covering about 21,000 years. So, in other words, you know, if it was 900, you know, exactly, that would be 230 generations with the primates, right? Because you had 70, the dawn mammals, and then, if you look back, you know, remember it's at the end of, I should just point out so you can remember that, at the end of section 2 is where they give you the 70 generations for the dawn mammals. And then, what is it, 5 paragraphs in on the mid-mammals, they give you that 15,000 years, 600 generations. Yeah. So you had 670 there, see, so about 230. And you had 15,000 years and 1,000 years, you know, and it was even one, it was like more than 1,000 and almost 15. So it's going to be pretty close to 16,000 years there. So we've got about 5,000 years for these roughly 230 generations.
Not very long.
Right? So you just
appear to
Yeah, and then finally, especially when you sum it all up, to go to something that is very much, you know, just like an animal, right? You know, in just 21,000 years, boom, we have the first two humans. And, I mean, we're talking, like we've been reading, fully upright with all of the emotional machinery and everything, right? Yeah, so it's really striking. You know, that's, you can see just how much it was quivering on the very brink, you know, even with that first suddenly to dawn mammals. Very short span of time. All right. Let's see. Oh, and just, yeah, the other thing to note, and you'll see they repeat this to emphasize it. They don't just say the first human beings. They say the first true human beings. Right? Because now you literally have that distillation of wholeness put into their mind by grace, right? There's a, you know, the truth has been expressed literally. There's an upper domain for an hourglass analogy of the creature's mind now, right? And that upper domain can embody wholeness, true human beings. Okay.
Thus it was that the dawn mammals, springing from the North American lemur type, gave origin to the mid-mammals, and these mid-mammals in turn produced the superior primates, who became the immediate ancestors of the primitive human race. The primates' tribes were the last vital link in the evolution of man, but in less than 5,000 years, not a single individual of these extraordinary tribes was left.
Right. So again, you know, it's the case, and this one's kind of fascinating. See, it's you know, roughly 5,000. So it's sort of 5,000 years up and 5,000 years gone, and that's it. Very scaffolding. Now we don't, you know, it doesn't tell you if the primates were all killed off by the Andonites, or if they just died off or what. For whatever reason, they were gone in the same short order as they arrived, 5,000 in and 5,000 out.
Yeah. So we have nothing to do with Neanderthal and all that. Those were.
We'll get to that. We do have a lot to do with Neanderthal. Okay. Right.
Just not
yet. We haven't gotten to that stuff yet. We'll actually learn the full details about quote unquote Neanderthals. But none of what we've just read about the dawn mammals, the mid mammals, or these primates, you know, scientists know nothing of that. Right? We have, like I was pointing out, the skeletal proportions, and they're talking about the primates. Okay, we have some of these. We have the skeletons of some of these other near human species from other parts of the world, like in Africa. Okay. Some of those other 7,000 strains, okay? None of those...
Go truly vertical.
Yeah, I mean, you had... we'll talk about that, you know, later. I mean, you had all these things continuing to get up to the, you know, to the human threshold, but not crossing the line. But none of them would have been as precisely focused as these primates, right? So, that's one of the reasons why, you know, we can find fossils of them. A lot of those species existed for long spans of time, and they were dead ends. See, here they're really stressing. I mean, this is just. These exist merely as a scaffolding fact, right? To get up to the cherry on top.
It's like they have a purpose, you know, that they needed to not be left.
Yeah. Yeah. And so as soon as they've served their purpose, again they disappear. Because again, it just speaks to that. It's a very efficient, purposed system. Right. The point of the universe is not to evolve the primates is to evolve will creatures. That's the only purpose.
Are you sure about that?
There's a vast diversity of will creatures, though. Some of whom are created by Creator Sons and Creator Mother Spirits, right? But, you know, exist, you know. There are evolutionary creatures, too. The whole universe exists for will creatures, no matter how they come into existence. Very quick, 900 generations and 21,000 years, and we've got it. All right, so now let's get to the point we've been building up to here.
Section 5, the first human beings. From the year AD 1934 back to the birth of the first two human beings is just 993,419 years.
Okay, so just that one tiny little fact to throw out, and just... You know, so now you can think precisely. You know, when at the dawn mammals, you know, at the beginning of the dawn mammals section, it said a little more than 1 million years ago. Yeah, I mean, just a little more, right? If I add 21,000 to that, I mean, it's just, you know, like about 14,000 years more than a million years, is all it was. You know, so it's. When we say, you know, the first two humans were a million years ago, yeah, we're kind of pointing to the fact that, you know, this 21,000 years is a difference of no consequence, right? I mean, it's just, it all happens just in the, you know, in the blink of an eye, basically. It is more and more, as you get to the whole point, right, it more and more seems to be literally a finger snap. Remember what that analogy I used. I mean, evolution is creativity and time. You know, these whole 550 million years, you know, of this evolution of life is, right, it's a creative finger snap where you just slow down this finger snap so that you can see all the details. It's just stretched out in time. And we're just noticing that the more it really gets to the whole point of the finger snap, right, the more it is effectively just a finger snap. It's like someone just snapped their fingers and boom, there were humans. Okay.
These two remarkable creatures were true human beings. They possessed perfect human thumbs, as had many of their ancestors, while they had just as perfect feet as the present-day human races. They were walkers and runners, not climbers. The grasping function of the big toe was absent. Completely absent. When danger drove them to the treetops, they climbed just like the humans of today would. They would climb up the trunk of a tree like a bear, and not as would a chimpanzee or a gorilla, swinging up by their branches.
You know, see, they're making a point of stressing this again, because they know how confused our scientists are. You know, and would continue to become as, you know, we went on from 1934 here, in this regard. You know, so they're really trying to stress this. Again, you're thinking as if this is all just some sort of an unpurposed phenomenon. It's like, no, it was very purposed, right? And they were true human beings suddenly, you know, as they stress that again, say true human beings, you know, and all the things that you immediately are looking for, were there from the get-go. Matter of fact, a lot of those things you're looking for were there before the get-go, right? The basic skeletal stuff and whatnot was all already there. They're just trying to drive that home. For those who want to think about the truth of our nature. Right? You don't reject the facts. You start with the truth and then go to the facts instead of starting with the facts like everyone is doing now, bottom up, and never getting to the truth. Yep.
Just thinking from a strictly biological point of view, what do you think is the timing mechanism that triggers the suddenly?
Again, you've got...
What'd she ask?
What's the timing mechanism that triggers the suddenly?
Oh, okay.
because the suddenlies are a phase change in the system, right, you have this constant influence is imposed upon the system from the top down, right? I mean, it's, you know, the over-control of evolution is through mind. And so mind engaged to the system, you know, is putting this constant influence upon the system, just like the analogy of you set the pot of water on the stove and you set the knob on the stove to a given position and don't touch it, you just leave it there. So there's this constant, you know, energy input into the pot of water, you know, and eventually it boils. Eventually there's a suddenly in that system. Right, so the timing is not because someone reaches in and turns the knob on the stove, right? The timing is inherent in the system. You know, it's once you
reach a certain point,
right? Once you see, the boundary conditions are set, the internal nature of the system is set, and it just when it reaches a certain point of evolution, there's a phase change, and you know, the life carriers understand all the physics of all that stuff, right? In the same way that we can predict when the pot of water is going to boil, right?
Not if you
watch
the pot.
There's always a wisecracker in there.
But they were watching closely.
Yes, they were watching closely, and then the pot still boiled. You know, so you know, it's all part of their design. Now, remember, see, they're designing some of the internal, and they're also controlling the boundary conditions, the environment. Okay, so, you know, they wanted to get that suddenly in a pre-sangic race, right? So they had it timed in their design to boil for that suddenly before the system normally produces the sangics. But it was all there in the single-celled plants that they put into the shallow seas. All that timing and everything was all inherent in the way they designed the genetics and this way they set up the environment. It's all just mind-boggling, you know, and it's sophistication, right? That you get all of this precision of the type of will creature, you know, starting with a single-celled plant, you know. It's a very high science, you know, that they're practicing. Okay, let's see here. So what else do we have there? We've got, right, so they're stressing, right? All of the basic biologic things are in place. Let's see. Just, you know, one little thing. Remember, swinging up by the branches. We've made this definitive shift as we've gone through from something, you know, that strikes you like a gibbon with these long arms, you know, the legs have gotten long, the arms have gotten shorter, we've gotten that proportion. So, and, you know, you've moved away from something that has that greater embodiment in their arms, you know, like chimps and gorillas, you know, to a human. Okay.
These first human beings and their descendants reached full maturity at 12 years of age and possessed a potential lifespan of about 75 years.
Okay, now that, see, too, it's just one little sentence, the paragraph, to again hit you. Okay, so in other words, oh, they're just like us, right? Full maturity at 12 years of age, right? I mean, you know, just, you know, basic... The basic issues that we recognize today, you know, the whole issues of when, you know, when is puberty and, you know, and all those sorts of things, right? It's all there, you know, and even, see, you know, it's a full, about 75 years longevity. Oh, 70 years or by reason of strength 80, you know, like the, you know, Psalm 90, Oh, so it started out fully in place, and all we've done is, if there's some back mating, that drops it down from 75 to 70, you know, 3 score years and 10, or by reason of strength, if there's some andite, you know, upstepping, it gets to 80 from 75.
Or like my mother at 103.
Now, obviously, you know, these are tails, right? But, you know, but just, you know, you have, you start with one bell curve, right? One bell curve where the center's at 75, right? You know, it's about 75. It's not like they drop dead at, you know, precisely 75, right? I mean, this is a bell curve, right? Some live a little longer, a little less, you know. But, of course, again, you know, no one's going to live to their ripe old age, right? But you've got his bell curve with the center at 75, and all you've really done, you know, is sort of, you know, create one bell curve that's kind of centered at 70 off of that one and one that's centered at 80, right? And, yeah, if you've got some better genetics, you're on the, you know, leading tail of the 81, and you'll live 90 or something, you know. But
we're supposed to rest till we live several hundred years. So
right.
Where's the evolution?
We would be living that
we're
way.
We're not
thriving
in the top down.
Right. See, that's one of the main points. See, it reminds you that even with all of that, you know, that biologic uplift, right, that we did get, it only modified this slightly, you know, and it's just all the more how much genetic engineering is going to have to be done to get it from, you know, basically where it started at 75 to 500.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, yeah, it's going to take a lot of genetic engineering to get it the rest of the way. And, you know, all of this, all the lengthening, you know, is that might come just from the bottom up, you know, is in the past. You know, that was all done before Adam and Eve got here. So it's all going to be genetic engineering. All right, so anyway, so that's, you know, that one really strikes you, that, you know, there it is, 3 score years and 10 are by reason of strength, 4 score, you know, that basic fact, just without the slight modification, is there in the first two humans. Boom. Right, so that final suddenly is, yeah, I mean, it's just there. Right? The biology is, you know, in many ways, there. All that foundational biology that gives you
there,
that gives you longevity and stuff.
Five more years to go.
Yeah. So again, it reminds you that, you know, the big thing that's to happen post, you know, these first two humans is mindal, right? Not so much, you know, biological. I mean, there are some some material things, but, you know, the big thing, right, is the mind. You know, and that's another thing that's sad to record right now. We still are so fixated on our bodies. Right, you know, one day, we'll get from fixation on quantity to quality. Right, we'll be striving for quality of thinking. You know, not just quantity of thinking, like we were pointing out, that you can actually get by just having a bigger brain. It's not very profound. All right.
Many new emotions early appeared in these human twins. They experienced admiration for both objects and other beings and exhibited considerable vanity. But the most remarkable advance in emotional development was the sudden appearance of a new group of really human feelings, the worshipful group, embracing awe, reverence, humility, and even a primitive form of gratitude. Fear, joined with ignorance of natural phenomena, is about to give birth to primitive religion.
Woohoo! let's hear for fear joined with ignorance.
Do we have to keep hearing
these? and remember when they tell you in the religion papers, there's the religion of primitives, and there's the primitive religion of us, and there's no difference. Okay, so remember. You know, we got some of the stuff laid in place, these foundations with the Dawn Mammals. Remember how they said they were very affectionate? Okay? Right, but that was just affectionate, just that basic fancy animal feeling. Right? You know, and like I mentioned, I think it was, you know, it was last week. A lot of times, that's all we mean when we use the word love. Right? It, really, you're just talking about that basic, just rudimentary feeling of affection. Right? But now we're bringing in, right? We've brought in some of that higher reflective and self-conscious nature, right? They're true humans. So you can have, you know, a sense of wonder, right? So there's admiration, okay? You know, so that's a way, you know, starting with just affection, you can go that direction to admiration. You know, you also bring in because, you know, you have a self-aware self now, right? Right? Before you had consciousness, now you have self-consciousness, right? So you can bring in vanity, right? And you have a self-aware self. So the pronoun I is in existence now, right? The Latin word ego, self-aware self, is in existence now. You've got the sixth adjutant, right? So the sixth adjutant energy can juice up those basic foundational emotions that we've put in place, right? And so you have, you know, awe and reverence, for instance, like they're pointing out. Yeah, because remember, now you directly have the levels of meaning. So, you know, you actually have the second level of meaning now, the level of the feelings, with awe on the individuality end of that spectrum and reverence on the unity end of that spectrum of feelings. But remember, right, even in its highest mode, reverence, that's, you know, the root of the word reverence is Latin for fear, right? It's re-fear, you know. It's, fear remade, right? So it still is all just fear, you know, exalted, you know, anguish and dread and awe and reverence. Okay, but, you know, it's getting fancier and fancier with the sixth adjutant in play. So yep.
In the book, I've seen reverence used for very high beings. It can be a very high thing.
Right. But it's one thing to have the feeling of reverence as a consequence of higher objective consciousness. But it's when all it is just going from the bottom up and peaking at reverence.
Yeah, I'm just saying that it is up there.
Yes. Right. I mean, if you actually get up to genuine worship of God, right, that has a casts a shadow down to the level of the feelings as a feeling of very sublime reverence.
Yeah, exalted reverence.
Right? But see, the problem is, you know, most people are just getting up to reverence and thinking they've gotten to worship. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, the reverence of unity is not the worship of God. Mm-hmm. Right? Right? So, again, worship produces reverence, but reverence doesn't, you know, produce worship. Reverence is not worship. It's just a feeling. Right? It's not a synchronization with the whole holistic nature of the cosmos. It's just a feeling. It's subjective, not objective. Okay, but see, again, you have that which, when you have a little bit of reflective consciousness or self-consciousness, you know, giving you something. So that produces some of these differentials, but some of them are just juicing something with the energy of the sixth adjutant. Okay, and there's not really any reflection element. It's just a yet fancier feeling. But you bring in humility, obviously you're bringing in a little bit of reflection, see? Or even a primitive form of gratitude. So in other words, you know, as they indicate in the final sentence there, you now have someone who can follow the ladder of prayer up to a primitive form of Thanksgiving. They're not, you know, very sophisticated. Remember, the prince and his staff are not going to arrive for another 500,000 years, right? So these are very primitive humans, you know, in those higher issues.
Chris, one more kind of funny thing. I do wonder how they express vanity, being that primitive.
What did they do? Look at how we primitives express vanity, and then you know how they did. Right?
What?
How we primitives express vanity, and you know how they did it. They do it exactly like we do.
Well, we have mirrors.
You know, they could.
They have water.
They could look for their reflection and they're trying to impress everyone. So, you know, immediately you're going to get all kinds of adornment going on and whatnot. Yeah. You know, and the primitive mode of adornment is being rediscovered, quote unquote, you know, as we descend, right? People are adorning themselves in more and more primitive ways, you know. So, you know, when you look at some people today, you know exactly what one of these Andonites look like. They had that thing in their ear, yeah.
They didn't have just like today. Something like it.
They didn't have the tattoo.
No.
Because they didn't have tattoo parlors.
That's yeah. Remember the word for gold in Latin, right? It's the same as the word for ear in Latin, right? It goes back a long way. That gold and ear go together, right? Earrings are very ancient fact. ear equals gold and gold equals ear as far back as anyone can remember, okay?
Yeah, we like our earrings.
Right? Not I.
Besides, you discovered there's more than just vanity there. There are also fishing lures. You remember, what did they say here very early on with the Don Mammals? Food hunger and sex craving were well developed. Right. The fishing lure aspect, you know, is being discovered here too. But you know, you've got that basic fear-based religion that goes forward almost unchanged to today in place again, right from the get-go with the first humans.
Yeah, but see, they were the only two at first.
Yep.
So the only way that they could try to, what's the word? Enamor somebody.
Would
be each other.
Your king.
And you'll see that they had that going, you know, very early on, even before they.
What was it?
I said there was only the two of them, so you know they were saying that.
And they were delighted in each other very early, at a very early age, as we're about to read here. It starts to get very poignant here in a second here. All right, so keep going here.
Not only were such human feelings manifested in these primitive humans, but many more highly evolved sentiments were also present in rudimentary form. They were mildly cognizant of pity, shame, and reproach, and were acutely conscious of love, hate, and revenge, being also susceptible to marked feelings of jealousy.
Okay, so again, we're going to get a little bit more sophisticated. They're reminding you that it's still in a rudimentary form here because they're just the Andonites and not yet the Sangiks. But they're just mildly cognizant. See, but nonetheless, there's a little bit of reflective nature. So there can be pity, shame, reproach. Remember, we touched on that before. Where they said that there was a self-abasement in the Don Mammals bordering on shame and remorse. Right, but just bordering on, because there wasn't the reflective element to actually get you across that threshold. But we've got that now in a mildly cognizant mode. But you've got the sixth adjutant definitively juicing things up. Right, so they were acutely conscious. Right, so that's the sixth adjutant. You know, of something now that you're going to call love, of course, all it is that affection fact that was there from the Don Mammals, juiced up by the sixth adjutant. It's not technically love, right? And that's why the revelators cringe at using L-O-V-E for that sixth level of meaning fact, right? The personal realization of divine fellowship, right? When all we can really imagine relative to that word is sixth adjutant juicing of affection, right? To something that was so passionate that we call by a different word than affection. Yeah, you know, we want, you know, we use this word love. See, but again, see, that's because we have language. So the word love comes down into our heads and they go, I think it's applied to this thing, right? It's like, no, it's four levels up from that. What that word, the fact that that word is supposed to be applied to, right? But we know enough to apply it to kind of the fanciest thing that we've experienced. But it's sad the regards, eh? Right? And, you know, like Jesus said, I find you on the second level of meaning, right? Where the fanciest thing you've experienced, you're calling love. And it's merely just a juiced up feeling. It's just fancy affection that the dawn mammals had. Right? You know, and of course you've got the contrast of hate. You know, and then you get all these other very, you know, impassioned things juiced up by the sixth agent, revenge and jealousy and whatnot. Okay. And remember what they say in this civilization papers about jealousy. There's nothing natural about jealousy. That's not a nature fact. That's a nurture fact. As much as that seems to be purely biologic in our experience, it's not. We impose that on ourselves.
We have to be.
Yeah, yeah. You take that on.
I don't really have clear in my mind the importance of shame and remorse. You know, modern intellectuals try to downplay those things as something negative.
Oh,
and they're obviously pointing them out here as this is something foundational.
Yep, it is.
To being a true human.
Right, so what is it? So shame and remorse, those sorts of feelings, what's that the beginnings of? That's a beginnings of a moral consciousness. Right? Which, you know, is the predicate for an ethical consciousness. Right? You know, humility, you know, is in play there too. I mean, that you become a self-aware self, and you recognize your smallness, your immaturity, your imperfection, your lack of synchronization with the cosmos. You have to start out with a sense of if you're going to respond to a recognition that you have a duty to the cosmos, that you have a moral duty, right? I mean, there has to be some basic sense in you that you don't have that by nature. You don't like how it feels that you don't have that by nature, and you're going to try to rise up and get that, right? You're ashamed, you know, at how unconsecrated to the universal harmony you are, right? You know, it has to, you know, it starts out with cattle prods, right? You have to be just prodded to go up. And eventually, you know, you become a second miler. And it's free service and liberty-loving devotion. But before that, right, if you don't have shame and remorse and stuff, you can't get, you know, even to the beginning of first miler, let alone work your way through first miler to get to the threshold of second miler, right? You know, it's the first miler, second miler is a lot like the early phase of evolving, you know, progressing civilization and the advancing phase, right? The four indispensables early on are cattle prods, slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. Right? You know, and then you go to true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness, right, in the second phase. It's just, again, it's just that those basic you have to be designed, programmed to not like the feeling of your immaturity and want to be less immature. Right? You don't initially go, you know, have this high-minded, you know, you're not born as an adult of God. Right? So, yeah, it's the beginnings of morality. Right? Well, and if you don't have morality on the fifth level of meaning, you can't get to religion on the sixth.
Yep. It seems like shame and remorse come really swiftly and immediately in my life, I notice. And then it goes if I pay attention to that. But it's like right there, like as soon as I fall off track.
Yeah, see, and again, that's because it's coming in because of that reflective thing. So it's in the moment. Right? Your insights are instantaneous.
Right.
They don't, you know, require a long stretch of time to grind into existence.
Sometimes they're just it's a boom. Long stretch, though, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it may take you a while,
like,
but again, it's sort of like just once everything is in place, you know, it's an immediate recognition. Oops.
Yeah, but some things take months. Or even years.
Yeah, right.
So it depends on what it is. But yeah. I just noticed that swiftness more and more.
I've noticed that sorrow takes hard. That's a hard one.
Yeah, it depends on which sorrow.
Yeah, right. And see, and remember, a lot of these things have an enduring nature because, right, you have a material mind. There's a momentum, an inertia to a material mind. I mean, you don't just turn it on a dime. It goes on. But that which you can't forget in time will be forgotten in eternity.
Yeah. I seem to forget a lot faster.
What did he just say? I can't remember. Let's see. All right. Let's keep going here.
These first two humans, the twins, were a great trial to their primates' parents. They were so curious and adventurous that they nearly lost their lives on numerous occasions before they were 8 years old. As it was, they were rather well scarred up by the time they were 12.
Right, so they, your first thought is, oh, well, maybe it's because they're very juiced up by the sixth adjutant, and that's why they're a handful. You know, but remember, we'll read here next, you know, that imagine our joy one day, the twins were about 10 years old when the spirit of worship made its first contact. Okay, so, you see, that didn't happen until a ways down. But you've got, curious and adventurous. I mean, you've got the fourth and fifth adjutants functioning in a much more definitive mode. And it means, see, you have it. See, what you have is, even though you don't literally have the sixth and seventh adjutants and the Holy Spirit, you know, encircuited when they're quite young, the first five adjutants know that's coming. Right? I mean, the truth is in play. They're true human beings. And so the lower adjutants, are an antecedent following, if you will. See, you know, they can go further, knowing that that's, you know, that greater ministry from above is coming. See, than they could before. See, and it's the same. You know, if it's like that way, the total finite. You know, where like you can have Majestan, you know, being created from a time viewpoint. The creator, the supreme being, isn't there yet. You know, until the end of all that antecedent following stuff. What's which is first and which is last? You know, both. Right. You see that. Right. So I mean, that's why. You know, even when you're 3 years old, you have a behavior that's quite advanced, right? You know, and you know, you appear to be literally functioning in a human mode. It's like, well, yes, but technically, you're not technically, in fact, human until roughly age six, right? But it's just the adjutants are all, you know, foreshadowing, right, if you will, or whatever. See, you know, that coming higher ministry. Yeah, because remember, it's all within the Creative Mother Spirit's mind. It's not like, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing here, right? Yeah, so you've got these, you know, everything is juiced up, even about literally pouring the gasoline in with the sixth adjutant. And so these kids are a handful.
Oh my gosh, because all of these decades of reading this book, my entire life, my entire conscious life, it never has the thought of course, the adjutants are all working together,
yeah.
You know, and they're planning, and they're seeing this coming along, and
right, the wholeness
is just blows me out of the water, because, yeah. I mean, it's just a whole new
way of looking
yeah.
at it.
Yeah,
yeah. And the word key word is whole there. See, the wholeness is all in her mind, right? Right? So... Yeah, just appreciate it. That's, you know, that again, it's, you know, it's like, that's why they stress the word true there. See, that the wholeness is so obviously there now, right? Parts do things that parts shouldn't be able to do, right? Because it's not just parts. They're parts within a whole now, right? Okay. Yes, yeah. Every mom can appreciate this. Ah, yes, the handful thing. And you know, you can't help but notice they threw in the 8 years of 8 years old. See, already there. You know, that very foundational block of time up to eight. You know, even for us today. All right. Let's keep going here.
Very early, they learned to engage in verbal communication. By the age of 10, they had worked out an improved sign and word language of almost 100 ideas and had greatly improved and expanded the crude communicative technique of their ancestors. But try as hard as they might, they were able to teach only a few of their new signs and symbols to their parents.
Okay, so it's taking the step. Notice they use the word language, see? And they even emphasized how much potential is in play by just the way they worded it. You know, you could say, why on earth did they say almost 100 ideas? Why didn't they say almost 50 ideas?
That's the way they talk. Have you ever noticed?
Yeah, but why do they talk that way?
Oh, no.
Right, what, right? This is a revelation of truth, not of fact. Right? They're trying to, right? In other words, they're on the road to 100.
The cup is half full, not half
empty. Right, see? Purposely said it that way so that you can follow that forward, right? They're not maxing out at almost 50, right?
Yeah.
By the age of 10, right, they were halfway to 100.
I'm glad their vanity wasn't crushed by their scar tissue.
All the more reason for adornment to cover up the scars.
What's this ear thing? Look at that neck thing.
Early on, they invented cover. cover up the scars. Let's see here. Okay. And you notice how there's this ever greater drive to teach those who are coming up behind you. See? Yeah, but... try as hard as they might. Yes. All right.
When about 9 years of age, they journeyed off down the river one bright day and held a momentous conference. Every celestial intelligence stationed on Urantia, including myself, was present as an observer of the transactions of this noontide tryst. On this eventful day, they arrived at an understanding to live with and for each other. And this was the first of a series of such agreements which finally culminated in the decision to flee from their inferior animal associates and to journey northward, little knowing that they were thus to found the human race.
OK, Okay, so again, see, this is just nine, but look at the sophistication. So pre-sixth adjutant yet, and pre-factualization, you know, a long ways yet of their literal, you know, a literal personality being identified, right, a literal encirclement of the Holy Spirit. But you've got, yeah, you have the beginnings of reflection, see, even without the Holy Spirit. They're getting, you know, see, the adjutants are functioning at a very sophisticated level, you know, and you see how endeared to one another they already are at nine, right?
And it's yeah, not just one, culture
yeah.
around them saying, you know, you're supposed to do this or that. It's discovery of that.
Yeah, and very individual, see. You know, and it's, you know, you got to love it, a little bit of poetry, one bright day, and it's a noontide tryst, right?
Noon is momentous a lot.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and you always have that noon thing happening, yes.
It's amazing they have enough to, I mean, of those 50 ideas, that's enough to communicate all that.
Yeah, and see, they arrived at an understanding to live with and for each other. See, again, the sophistication of the fifth adjutant, see, that's in play there. That, you know, that energy of socialization is functioning at, you know, quite profound levels. Yeah, and then they're just hinting about what we haven't read yet, you know, about how we know they go northward and everything when this all culminates.
Yeah, north and west.
Okay.
While we were all greatly concerned with what these two little savages were planning.
Sound familiar?
Think tryst.
My old parents aren't noticing any of this, but we're all noticing.
We were powerless to control the working of their minds. We did not, could not, arbitrarily influence their decisions. But within the permissible limits of planetary function, we, the life carriers, together with our associates, all conspired to lead the human twins northward and far from their hairy and partially tree-dwelling people. And so, by reason of their own intelligent choice, the twins did migrate. And because of our supervision, they migrated northward to a secluded region where they escaped the possibility of biologic degradation through admixture with their inferior relatives of the primates tribes.
And so you see that. So now it's, you know, it's very definitively in play that the life carriers want to try to do everything they can within the limits of their, you know, what they're allowed to do to prevent that backmating. You know, but obviously, see, the Andonites could easily mate with the primates or, you know, all these other primate-like, you know, species that developed subsequently.
What do you think they did every time they started to go south, that lightning struck?
Well, you notice how coy they are about this. You know, because, you know, remember, once they're will creatures, you know, the life carriers have a very hands-off orders, you know, in play, as they're referring to there. Plus, see, not only is it did not, but it's could not. You know, once you have the encirclement in the Holy Spirit, the force field's up.
Yeah.
Right? You know, even if you had like secondary midwares in play, right? I mean, they can't go in and just puppet the mind like, you know, a literal animal, right? That's the could not thing.
But they had some kind of supervision.
Yeah, and so, you know, you notice how they, the life carriers and whatnot are up to some sort of clever conspiracy here, right, that gets them to go northward. You know, they're always frustratingly, you know, void of details on these things, like exactly how did the Andonites end up, you know, at the prince's headquarters, and, you know, all it's all being done, it's seen some similar way.
A yellow brick road
You know, I don't know. Yes, follow the yellow brick road.
There was a tree in the way.
Yeah, you know, whatever the heck they did.
It was pretty over there. But
you notice also that even though it seemed like we were at the point where we're probably, you know, not much hair left, in relative terms, they're still describing the primates as hairy. So, yeah, you know that from what they said before that the primates had to have been pretty, limited hair. They mentioned the mid-mammals. Remember what they said about the mid-mammals? They had little hair on their bodies, but this was no disabilities. They lived in a warm and equable climate. Remember that? You know, so, so the primates would have had even less, but still, apparently, there was a relatively significant step. And again, it reminds you, the only reason that some humans have a bit of hair is because of the back mating. Okay. All right, it's the primates and other species that were, kind of similar that had a little more hair than, the first true humans. And, so like you get some, European guy with tons of hair on his chest and back. I mean, that's because of the back mating, that was fed into that European stock. All right, that's not there in an uncorrupted human stock.
So it's okay to call the person you animal.
Yeah. But of course, remember they said, even though you got unfortunate things like hair, back hair, some of those other stocks that we backmated with did feed in some helpful genetics.
Thank God.
Yeah, there were some positives. It wasn't all negative. But anyway, let's see, where were we? All right, so they're motivated, or coaxed, I should say, northward. And
behold, migrate northward.
Oh, yeah. Why did they italicize migrate?
Because they're not really migrating.
Right. I mean, just yeah. They quote unquote migrated. Coincidentally, northward. They're just highlighting that. It appeared that they migrated northward, but really, we were kind of nudging them. Yes, and we herded northward. Yes, yes. Okay.
Shortly before their departure from the home forests, they lost their mother in a gibbon raid. While she did not possess their intelligence, she did have a worthy mammalian affection of a high order for her offspring, and she fearlessly gave her life in the attempt to save the wonderful pair. Nor was her sacrifice in vain, for she held off the enemy until the father arrived with reinforcements and put the invaders to rout.
Okay, so, besides the poignancy there, again, there's this little reminder. See, notice they used the word affection. So just reminding you, how profound mere animal affection can be, right? Especially if you combine it with the maternal instinct, right? As you're doing here. She fearlessly gave her life. I see. So, it's a profound thing, but it's fancy animal. That's not genuinely human. That can happen just naturally with the functioning of the adjutants, the first five. Mm-hmm. See, and so it's a reminder, to not overplay these things, right? I mean, when someone does that, that is like, well, now that is a pinnacle of human quality. It's like, well, what about no greater a love as man than he would lay down his life? Oh, but I've got to think about that anew, right? It's like the difference between monogamy and true monogamy. Right? I mean, there's lots of just simple animals that are factually monogamous. Right? But they're not truly monogamous. Right? And, when Jesus is saying no greater love, right, he's talking about something that is being done from the top down in the recognition of the full wholeness of things. You know, not something that just happens naturally bottom up, you know, with certain adjutant functioning and a little bit of maternal instinct thrown in. Okay.
But it is a foundation that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Right, yeah, and it's there as a, it's like, okay, I can take that, the essence of that, up, right? I mean, that's the point. It's like, there's always an essence there, but just think about taking that essence up, rather than just, this is the total package right here, let's just stop here, right? See the thread of truth that's going through that and continue to follow it up, right? That juiced up affection called, it's usually called love, okay, don't just throw it out. There's a thread of truth going through that. Follow it up. Don't declare it to be a complete lifestyle solution, right? To be the totality of it, of the potential. That's what we're trying to get at. All right, you know, and then, you know, no maternal instinct or even paternal instinct, but you've got the basic juicing that a male has, and he and his buds come in and pound on him. So hail testosterone. All right, then what else do we have here?
Soon after this young couple forsook their associates to found the human race, their primate's father became disconsolate. He was heartbroken. He refused to eat, even when food was brought to him by his other children. His brilliant offspring having been lost, life did not seem worth living among his ordinary fellows. So he wandered off into the forest, was set upon by hostile gibbons, and beaten to death.
See, and both of those, see, I mean, notice how they gave you a female vignette and a male one, and the males should be, you know, and the females should each be able to resonate with the essence there, right? You know, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of gals even understand that guys will have this tendency to respond like that. You know, see, and that's rooted all the way back in, you know, in the primates, you know. Yeah, he's unconsolable. You know, he's apart from consolation, right? He's disconsolate. And see, notice they even stress that even though literally he doesn't have an upper domain of the hourglass, effectively he's heartbroken, right? He's effectively disillusioned, even though he can't literally be disillusioned because he doesn't have an encirclement in the Holy Spirit. So just, again, pointing out how profound the five adjutants can function. Remember how profoundly they function, you know, in the spranaja. Right? There's, just because it's not like you've got these seven parts. Right? No, I mean, there's seven phases of a whole. Right? I mean, there's, so those five parts can function in a way that's almost as if the other two parts were there. Right? It can get quite profound.
But he was a lot further along than any animal we have on Earth today.
Yes, see, much, much more. See, and that's because you're reading, it's like, well, no animal behaves like that. Only humans behave like that. See, that's, right. Yeah, that's the whole point.
Really relate to that without that experience. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like he was kind of close to being like what they were like, and almost something in him wanted that.
Yeah.
See, but he didn't quite get there.
Not to mention, remember, there's a mind linkage.
Right.
They were his adjutants.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Who was
remember, for us, we're not literally separated from the space that our parents, our biologic parents, are using in the mind energy system until roughly age 16. So that's another reason why, you know, Anda and Infanta do have hearts. Right, and see, and so there's a degree to which their parents kind of have a bit of human like behavior because they're getting that from their children. Right, it's like a child getting an adjuster, you know, right away if their parents have adjusters. See, you know, it's that you know, they're basically using the same mind. So the degree.
Of the brotherhood.
Right. So yeah, getting to the point where we all kind of have that, you know, are in a common space like that. Right? Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, so there's two reasons why they can use such strong terms like this. You know, it's a combination of you know, those two primates were made different mindily, mentally by their children. You know, like none of the other primates. It's not just because they were kind of the pinnacle and they gave, led to the. I mean, there's some feedback, right? Their children lifted them up effectively a little bit.
Yeah.
See? You know, and so it was an awful lot of the hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny happening there, even though they were, you know, his mom was just an animal. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. All right. Or did I say his? Their mom. Their mom. All right. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Yeah. So anyway, you know, it's a challenge for guys to not let yourself get so depressed that you drop down into that, you know, that mode, you know, and just want to go off and have yourself beaten to death by the gibbons. Yes.
There used to be my drinking buddies.
Yeah. You know, you can definitely get out. I'll just get it over with.
His,
you know,
function was over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get some more here.
Section 6: Evolution of the Human Mind. We, the life carriers on Urantia, had passed through the long vigil of watchful waiting since the day we first planted the life plasm in the planetary waters. And naturally, the appearance of the first really intelligent and volitional beings brought to us great joy and supreme satisfaction.
Okay. Just, you know, I think that's pretty obvious. You know, just, you know, and, you know, just remind yourself how long they've been waiting. Right.
And Moses, the 40 years of watchful waiting. Just, this was, what, a million years?
I mean, great joy and supreme satisfaction. I mean, you can just, you know, try to imagine, put yourself in the place of those life carriers, right? You know, you've been staring, you know, at the single-celled plants for 550,000 years, or 550 million years, you know, waiting and waiting and waiting, and finally... remember, you know, with the Dawn Mammals, and exhibiting considerable elation when successful at any undertaking. Oh, the life carriers have that. So the Dawn Mammals had a downstepped expression of what the life carriers had. It just reminds you of how everything is coming down from above. But the elation that those, you know, that those life carriers had at that point, excitement.
We have been watching the twins developmentally through our observation of the functioning of the seven adjutant mind spirits assigned to Urantia at the time of our arrival on the planet. Throughout the long evolutionary development of planetary life, these tireless mind ministers had ever registered their increasing ability to contact with the successively expanding brain capacities of the progressively superior animal creatures.
Yeah, so, you know, so they've had they've been keeping close tabs on exactly, you know, the functioning of that focalized mind energy here.
At first, only the spirit of intuition could function in the instinctive and reflex behavior of the primordial animal life. With the differentiation of higher types, the spirit of understanding was able to endow such creatures with the gift of spontaneous association of ideas. Later on, we observed the spirit of courage in operation. Evolving animals really developed a crude form of protective self-consciousness. Subsequent to the appearance of the mammalian groups, we beheld the spirit of knowledge manifesting itself in increased measure. And the evolution of the higher mammals brought the function of the spirit of counsel, with the resulting growth of the herd instinct and the beginnings of primitive social development.
Yeah, just quickly there, you know, if you have the chart, you know, the threefold actuality with, you know, with the unity chart, you know, the way I've added those additional elements, you know, next to the names, you know, the spirit of whatever name for the adjutant, you know, you can, you know, that's, remember more precisely what's being surveyed there. You know, you start out with the energy of instinct for the first adjutant. See, could function in the instinctive and reflex behavior, right, of the primordial animal life. And going forward, I mean, you don't technically have the spirit of understanding. You have the energy of rationalization. Right? And, you know, here, and I don't need to hold that the whole time. I can just, you know, give you a little quickie there. I mean, you know, when they say the gift of spontaneous association of ideas, well, you know, I mean, you don't technically have ideas until you have humans, right? But you have, you know, the beginnings of what becomes that reflective object, you know, that is an idea in a human. You know, and that basic association, you know, the second adjunct, that's the associative one, right? And so, you know, connecting the dots, the energy of rationalization, right? Putting two and two together. That fact that, you know, even though it isn't literally the spirit of courage, it's just the energy of loyalty in the animal, that bit about evolving animals really developed a crude form of protective self-consciousness. Okay, they aren't literally, you know, don't literally have consciousness of consciousness. You know, they aren't a self-aware self, but they have the beginnings of it. You know, in order to have some crude awareness of your individuality, you need to have this first measure of separation from that individuality. With those first three adjutants, you know, start out with the individuality one, the first. Then the associativity one, the second, and then the unity one, the third, right? When you can back away from that, you know, rudimentary individuality, you know, in that rudimentary unity space of the third adjutant, see, you have a, as they're saying there, a crude form, you know, and it's going to be in that protective mode, self-consciousness. And so there's that you've got that first, you know, full spectrum from individuality to unity. So you can get that, you can back away from your individuality a little bit. You know, and so, you know, the dog can, you know, can sacrifice itself for the sake of its master, you know, sort of a thing. It's like, you know, I've just got to do this for my master. You know, it's, you know, you can anthropomorphize it. It's like he's actually saying to himself, you know, self-aware self, you know, it's time for you to make a sacrifice for the sake of the greater good. You know, that isn't technically what's going on, but it's that rudiment is there. You know, and then see, pointing out that you start to get the fourth adjutant, you know, functioning in significant ways when you get the mammals, and like we've been talking about, you know, you start to get, you know, even, crude tool making when it gets sophisticated enough, you know, and that sort of thing. And then that basic energy of socialization, like they're pointing out, that when you get that you have when you get the fifth, right? So that you have the beginnings of primitive social development. That's just the energy of socialization, the fifth adjutant in an animal. That's just the way that adjutant functions. You know, there's no reflective awareness of a society, right, or anything like that.
There
right?
is an elephant.
They aren't looking at it from the top down, but it appears that they're looking at it from the top down because they have this whole societal structure, yeah, and they seem to be aware of it, but see, they aren't technically, right? That's just the way the fifth adjutant functions. Yeah, the fact that has the top-down point of view is the creative mother spirit. It's her mind, right? But the individuals, the elephants, don't have that, right? They move within her top-down space. See, they don't establish that themselves. So we can see that ourselves and establish it ourselves. Right?
It was the fifth adjutant that made him bring his buddies in to fight off the people that were attacking his wife in a way.
I mean, you
almost had to work
right
together.
Yeah, that whole bit, males had already begun to develop all that sophistication of working together in a group, that use of the fifth adjutant, you know, to so that you could wage war effectively, and yeah, that was already happening back then.
It's interesting because when you look, you know, at the things on TV about, you know, lions attacking, you know, a herd of buffalo or whatever, the herd of buffalo would never turn around as a group try to fight the lion.
Right, yeah.
Because they would always win.
Right, they would always win.
But they don't do that. They
hundreds of, you know, of wildebeest or whatever in one lion, yes.
So you can sort of see the differential.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Except for like
horses. And yet they hang out together.
Yeah.
Fight. I mean, they'll, you know, the horses will. Did you ever see that video?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of that horse that went after the alligator or something.
Yeah.
And stopped it.
Right. I mean, you know, so there's.
And, the, you know, they are.
But your whole point is, you know, just how sophisticated a use of the fifth adjutant is there. Right.
And the other thing that's interesting is that we, just because we have the sixth and seventh, you know, you can also see how the first five act in us.
Right.
You
know? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Even you know, at levels that are probably higher than at the level.
Yeah, and that was the point I was just going to make. You know, as I stepped through those and I said the energy of this, that, and the other thing, right? In a human, you can approach those adjutants from the top down, right. You know, and they can have a, you know, very high, I mean, almost, you know, endlessly high, you know, expressions as the spirit of something, right? You know, a human can have understanding, right? And there's an adjutant that's the spirit of that understanding. A human, you know, can have knowledge, and there's an adjutant that's the spirit of that knowledge, right? So the foundational, you know, element of that, impulse of that knowledge. Not knowledge itself, but, right? Right, so, yes, that, and, you know, and for the first time, these adjutants are, you know, technically the spirit of something, you know, once you have these first two humans. They haven't been that before. They've just been the energy of something. Okay, let's get a little more here.
Increasingly, on down through the dawn mammals, the mid mammals, and the primates, we had observed the augmented service of the first five adjutants, but never had the remaining two, the highest mind ministers, been able to function in the Urantia type of evolutionary mind.
Yeah, and just the one little thing I wanted to add there about this augmented service. One of the things, you can have a collective functioning of an adjutant, which can fool you. You think, well, that must be the fifth adjutant that's giving it that that social-like, you know, expression, or that it's like, no, it might be a lower adjutant functioning in a collective mode. You know, like maybe it's just the first adjutant functioning in a collective mode, and you've got single-celled animals working together in a colony. Right, so you have this whole complexity, but you know, obviously, with the primates. You have literally the fifth adjutant functioning at a very sophisticated level. You don't have some lower adjutant just expressing a collective grouping of creatures. Okay.
Imagine our joy one day. The twins were about 10 years old when the spirit of worship made its first contact with the mind of the female twin, and shortly thereafter with the male. We knew that something closely akin to human mind was approaching culmination. And when, about a year later, they finally resolved, as a result of meditative thought and purposeful decision, to flee from home and journey north, then did the spirit of wisdom begin to function on Urantia and in these two now recognized human minds.
And they noticed they're telling you, not only do you have the spirit of wisdom, but so you have the encirclement of the Holy Spirit, and you have personality. I mean, you've got choice going on, and reflection and everything. You know, you can actually have a purpose. Right? You can have will, action, purpose, you know, being expressed. And, you know, remember, we often refer to this. You know, it took 450 million years, right, to go from just the first adjutant to the sixth. How long did it go from this take to go from the sixth to the seventh? 1 year. Right? Yeah, pretty amazing. Yeah, but again, that has to be because there is no long-term six adjutanted creature. That's an unstable state. That'll just tear itself apart. And then you go, well, why did it make contact with the female before the male? Again, see, that's that that maternal instinct aspect there. That's the hand that rocks the cradle, still fraternizes with destiny, right? It's not as deep a reach for the sixth adjutant to get down to the female. She's built up a little bit higher. So as the sixth adjutant's coming down, it gets to the female before it gets down to the male. Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's so disturbing if you see, you know, a female totally corrupted. Okay, I mean, because that's, I mean, she has to literally negate some of that by grace biologic, you know, hill that she's made as, right? She's got to lower herself down, you know, in a very rudimentary biologic level that a male can't even do, right? So, anyway.
I just had a little reflection about the flee from home. Mm-hmm. Some of us had to kind of leave our tribe, our families to progress. Like, yeah. I went 2,500 miles and never looked back.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to be something about that.
Yeah, we all appreciate that even if it isn't a biologic drag issue, there's a mental drag that we need to liberate ourselves from. Right? You have to free yourself from the bondage of your environment or you can't progress. Yeah, it's nothing personal. Yeah, it's just the way it is.
This is the first time I realized that the mind adjutants, all seven, were here from the get-go. They didn't just come as needed.
Yeah.
So probably even when there was only plant life, they were here.
Yes, right. And again, remember, because technically do they have to journey anywhere? No. Creative Mother Spirit's mind is everywhere. It's not like they journey from Salvington to here. I mean, her mind fills all of Nevadon, right? I mean, you know, they're just anthropomorphizing it a bit, you know? I mean, you know, all that's happened is the mind that's always been here in this location in space, right, just focalized down, you know, in anticipation of engaging, you know, and is endlessly patient. It's the creative mother spirit, right, that's waiting. Okay, let's wrap it up here.
There was an immediate and new order of mobilization of the seven adjutant mind spirits. We were alive with expectation. We realized that the long-waited-for hour was approaching. We knew we were upon the threshold of the realization of our protracted effort to evolve will creatures on Urantia.
Again, whole point is to evolve will creatures. And just to remember this, because we'll come back to a specific reference to it down the road a ways. There was an immediate and new order of mobilization. Right? You had a first phase of mobilization. We've just moved into the second phase of mobilization of the adjutants. They'll talk about moving into the third phase later on. What's happened? I've mentioned this before. You know, initially you have the adjutants are trying to draw everything upward biologically. And as soon as you get the first two that cross the threshold, they shift into the second phase. You know, and they'll continue to draw things up, but they're not going to. Nothing is going to be drawn up across the animal to human threshold line, right? Unless, you know, Anna and Fauna get killed, right? You know, and then they go back to the first phase, and they would, you know, draw something up again. But see, it's shifted into a new mode. So you know, the fact that they didn't get killed off, the will creatures, they were ongoing, right? It stayed in that second phase, you know, and creatures can get really close, get completely biologically compatible, but they won't be drawn up. You know, those adjutants, those first five adjutants won't take that initial move upward to where the sixth can reach down and then the seventh. Yeah. So, see, we're in that mode. See, as of right at that point, where you were never going to get, you know, any more will creatures. But it's different on a normal world when you have all the agent races before you have any. I mean, you have all of the sangic races. Excuse me, all the sangic races before you have any will creatures, right? And they bring it across the threshold with the red man, and they bring it across, you know, et cetera, you know, one by one. See, so the adjutants are in a kind of a different mode here. I mean, it's just a very definitive boom. They shift gears, right, a million years ago. All right. We can pick that up a little bit more next time and finish this off. You'll see that they throw us a curveball in this final section that we'll bring up next time. Picks up a curious loose end that we didn't know we had from many papers back. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.